You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by John Zalzierny, who is the president of feature film production and literary management at Bellevue. Thank you for being on the show, John.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm going to read your bio here on your website. It's very impressive. I'm going to pick and choose. If there's something I miss, please jump in and let me know. But your clients' writing credits and directing credits include Infinite, Parallel, Eli, Bad Match, Better Watch Out, Heavy Trip, Office Uprising, Splinter, A Crooked Somebody, and others. Your clients have written feature scripts that are set up at Warner Brothers, Paramount, Fox, Lionsgate, basically everyone. You've got them all over the place. But the reason I had reached out to you and the reason I was very interested in getting you on is because you had a very good thread a couple of weeks back when the Blacklist selections were announced and your clients had a number of folks on the Blacklist. And I want to talk about that because I don't think people out in the real world who aren't connected to the industry understand exactly what the Blacklist is and how important it is for screenwriters of all stripes, but especially screenwriters who are just getting started, who are starting out. So let's talk about that. What is the Blacklist and how do you get your clients work on it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I remember when, you know, I first had a client on the annual Blacklist, my father was like, that's a good thing. You know, because it's usually not a term that's used in a positive way, which is why Franklin Leonard, who created it, was so brilliant to kind of recontextualize the phrase, the word. You know, the first thing I would say is there's two different blacklists, which can be a little confusing. It's one of the first things I talked to you about. There is the annual Blacklist, which is kind of how it originally started, which Franklin kind of started. He was looking for some scripts that he should read over the holiday break. And he pulled his kind of peers and they all voted and sent him a list and he shared that information. And it was something that was received very well because people are like, oh, this is crowdsourced. What is good, you know, and Franklin eventually turned that turned into an annual thing, which eventually became a business. And so the annual list is voted on by I don't know how many, but professionals in the industry. I should note, not representatives, not agents or managers, but producers, studio executives. Those are the people I believe. And again, I don't work for the Blacklist, so I don't know the voting criteria, but they vote on it. And then the scripts that they, you know, whoever gets the most vote is kind of the number one script, and then they're ranked. And I believe you have to get 7 votes to get on the list. It's either 6 or 7 or 8. I forget. But if you get 6 or 7 or 8, whatever the number that I'm blanking on, you then get on this annual list. And just to clarify, there is a website called The Blacklist, and that's different. That is where writers can pay a fee to have their script hosted on there and then pay additional fee to get a review of the script. And if the script gets a good enough review, I believe an 8 or higher, it is then the logline is sent out, disseminated to a bunch of producers and representatives. So there's two different sites, one that you pay to put your script up and another one that's kind of an annual list of the most well-liked scripts of the year. So just to kind of clarify those two differences, because sometimes people get very confused and they think that in order to get on the annual Blacklist, you need to have hosted your script on the website. And that is not the case. There has been the case, and I have personally experienced it, that a script that I found on the Blacklist website was then, you know, so good that I signed the person and we got it out to the rest of the town, and it ended up being on the annual Blacklist. So But the two things aren't necessarily connected, except that the same parent organization, oversees them both. So the annual blacklist, the reason it's been really helpful is Hollywood loves to be told, what's good, right? It's funny, in this space that we now have, I feel like, I don't know, I would say a filter, but there's a better word for it. I mean, it's what reviewers have always been. I mean, the people like, you should see this movie, you shouldn't see this movie, you look for someone, if you're at the movie theaters and, there's 10 movies, you're going to say, hey, what have you heard about this one? Have you heard that one's good? Have you heard that one's good? You're looking for some kind of reference point on it. If there's an annual list that says, here are the scripts that, 200, 300 executives all thought was the best, this one got the most votes, well, heck, it must be good, or certainly must be worth reading it and trying to understand why that script got the acclaim that it got. I think it can be very helpful in drawing attention to scripts that, maybe didn't sell initially or didn't get enough attention. One thing I really would specifically say is that, spec screenplays, that is screenplays that were written on speculation, that were written, were not paid to be written. There used to be a very vibrant marketplace for them. Certainly when I came into the industry in the early 2000s and, certainly before that, going back into the 80s and the 90s in particular, that marketplace has declined significantly, partially due to changing trends, focus on, IP, well-known IP, for many reasons. Not as many specs sell like they used to. Remember when I first came into the industry, it felt like $1 million specs sold twice a month. Now I don't think it happens once a year, or certainly I can't think of the last one. It used to be, well, why should I read this writer? Well, they just sold $1 million spec to Sony or something. Nowadays, because so few specs sell, how does a representative get a writer on people's radars? How do you make people aware of them? Well, one way to do that is to get them on that annual blacklist. If you are a very fancy producer or studio executive, you don't have the time to read a bunch of things. And if you're like, so if a rep calls up and says, this script is good, okay, well, every rep says that. But if they say, hey, this was number one on the blacklist or landed on the annual blacklist, well, it's already kind of been peer approved, if you will. And it certainly gives a certain amount of resonance to their acclaim. So I think that's why it's been something that has been received so well, is that the industry always looks to things like that for, it's like a movie, we had a client's movie got a lot of acclaim out of a festival, and suddenly people are really, really paying attention to it. Whereas prior to that, it was difficult to get them to pay attention. But once a bunch of reviewers said the movie was good, well, then people paid attention. It's kind of in that sense, you're looking for someone to kind of pre-approve something, and then, well, you're going to pay attention. And you couple that with the decline in the spec market and making it harder to distinguish up and coming writers. I think the two things kind of fed into each other.
Yeah. I want to come back to the decline in the spec market in a second, because it is an interesting shift in the marketplace. But let's just like, if you were sitting down with one of your writers on your roster at Bellevue, and they're like, yeah, John, you got to help me get this on the blacklist. Come on, it's great. We all know it's great. What do I need to do to get it there? How do you coach them beyond saying, well, write well,
right?
Do a good job writing, and then we'll go from there.
I would say the kind of scripts that end up on the blacklist, it's kind of like, what's a Sundance movie? If I was like, oh man, this Michael Bay movie is going to get into Sundance, you'd be like, that seems unlikely. Because when we think of Sundance movies, we think of a certain kind of movie. Same way that when we think of an Oscar movie, we think of a certain kind of movie. Scripts that end up on the blacklist tend to be, not always, but more often than not, kind of quirky, less commercial. That said, Snow and the Huntsman was on the blacklist. So it's a script, Infinite, that I produced, that my client Ian Shore wrote. So it's not always that, but more often than not, it is that. The same way that Sundance, I think The Raid was a midnight Sundance movie, or am I wrong? Was that a Slam Dancer?
South by South. Either that or TIFF or...
Right. And so my point being, like, you wouldn't think of The Raid as a festival movie per se, but it was. So, I don't want to say all blacklist scripts are a certain way, but you know, if someone had a great horror script, and it was a relatively straightforward horror script, I'd be like, look, let's just try to sell this one and get it made. I, you know, if it ends up the blacklist, great. I've had horror scripts end up in the blacklist numerous times, but it's not the given that it would be, say, for a more quirky or out there script, you know, to some degree, because executives, they read, I don't know, like 200 horror scripts a year. Maybe they only read like 20 or 30 quirky kind of biopics or something like that. So they're a little less burnt out on it and it feels more interesting to them. So, you know, first it'd be with the choice of subject matter. I, you know, let's say I've had a fair number of music biopics on there, Fleetwood Mac, Madonna, so on. One of my colleague, Kate Sharp, her client just did a Shania Twain biopic on there. So let's talk about music, for example, like subject matter. I had someone I was working with who really wanted to put Chris Christopherson biopic. Now, Chris Christopherson actually is an incredible story, but I think the reality is I don't know how resonant he is to people in their 20s or 30s right now, which, you know, are the kind of executives who are reading, the kind of CEs and VPs who are reading and judging for the blacklist. And so that was something where I was like, I don't know that's going to have the resonance. I was talking to a manager friend recently or a couple years ago, and he was like, why did you want to do the Chris Christopherson one? Why did you do Fleetwood Mac? I was like, is your assistant on the line? He's like, yeah, she is. I'm like, oh, and he's like, no, she isn't, but I can ask her. I was like, ask her if she knows who Chris Christopherson is. She's like, no, she's shaking her head. I'm like, ask her if she knows who Fleetwood Mac is. He goes, oh, she just started singing one of their songs. So like, you know, that's, yeah. You want to choose in subject matter. And I would say the next one would be timing of when we take it out. More often than not, we're going to take it out. The blacklist voting is in November. We're going to try and take it out in September, October, closer to the blacklist voting. The same way that an Oscar movie, you didn't take it out in March. You take it out closer to the Academy voting. So you end up in the fall, you know. Now, look, I've taken out scripts in March, April that did end up in the blacklist, you know, but that's maybe because they sold or some other thing happened or, you know. So that's just, again, it's not a rule. It's just kind of like good thinking. And then I would say the last point is maybe the most obvious point, which is, you know, if we want to get a script in the blacklist, we're going to disseminate it as broadly as we possibly can. So I've had a client, you know, recently was like, oh, why didn't we get the script in the blacklist? I'm like, well, because we only took it to 4 producers, you know, like, so like, that's not enough people to get it onto the list because we wanted to be, that was the strategy for the script. We wanted to be more on point about it. Mm-hmm. So it really depends. You want to get it as broad as possible so that, you know, if I take a script to 50 people, maybe, you know, 10% of that, or not even 10%, maybe 20% of that vote for the script, and we have 10 votes or something. And how also it has to be good. Got to be good.
Yeah. Do you think of these as like actual campaigns? I mean, you mentioned the Oscars and that's, you know, that has its own campaign rhythm, et cetera. Or is it just kind of a thing that happens and everybody is grateful for it? Because, I mean, you mentioned with the one writer, he's like, why isn't this on the blacklist? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you take it out to the producers you want to produce it. Mm-hmm. That's different than, you know, blasting it out to everyone and saying, hey, you got to read this. This is perfect.
There's different strategies for different scripts. You know, we had a script that was on the blacklist this year called A Hufflepuff Love Story that was kind of like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern meets Palm Springs story set in the Harry Potter universe. We're not going to sell that, you know, most likely. Unless Warner Brothers somehow incongruously decided they wanted to do it. But it was incredibly talented writer Sofia Lopez, who loved the Harry Potter universe and felt like it was a way for her to write her rom-com script and get it out there to people who are looking for rom-com scripts and they would think of her as a writer for them going forward, you know? So that was kind of the thinking behind that. On that one. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the original question. I was like, before.
No. Well, just in terms of strategies. I mean,
right,
there's different strategies
for different scripts, I would say.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, and so you're asking about a campaign. You know, one of the funny things is I am super open about my personal belief and strategy in terms of getting scripts on the blacklist. It's funny. I had a manager call, it's funny. Managers are very chummy and talk to each other all the time or supportive of each other. It's funny. It's like different from agents where it's not so much the same, but he was like, what's your secret? You know, cause I had, you know, the two number one scripts in a row in 2020 and 2021. And I had another one in 2016 and he's like, what was your strategy? And I'm like, strategy is exactly what I just described to you. And I don't have any campaign, you know, other than taking it out closer to the date. I don't like, there's no people in the Twitter. I was like, oh, what are the deals that are cut underneath? And like, I don't have the time to do that. And I certainly don't do it. It's just, it's weird. The only thing I do is the day that the votes ballots go out is I email people and say, hey, by the way, I remember that you liked this script. You should maybe vote for it. And that's it. I just remind people that they read the script. And maybe there's a couple other scripts they could read if they'd like to. And that's it. It's one email. It's a reminder, you know.
Yeah.
That's about the length of it. I think the idea of a campaign is, you know, it's not the Oscars. It's not anything like that. And people are going to do what they're going to do. And all you can do is put material in front of them and hope that they connect with the person, you know, especially for someone like myself, where I think I, as a manager, had 6 scripts on the list there. I don't have the time to go in and cut deals for every single script. It just doesn't work that way. I'm not saying that it's not possible that someone might not do something shady. Certainly anything is possible, but on a widespread thing, it doesn't make, honestly, fiscal sense, because I don't get a, you know, it's my company. So, but anyways, yeah. I don't get any kind of, you know, financial bonus every time a script gets on the blacklist. It doesn't work that way.
Right. But you do, I mean, assuming that it helps get the script sold or your clients hired, there is some minor.
There's definitely, you know. There's definitely, and there can be, I'll put it like that. There can be. I've had clients get scripts in the blacklist, couldn't get an agent afterwards, you know? Mm-hmm. One of the things I talk a lot about is, you know, if the script is getting your work out there into the larger world, what are the opportunities that come out of that? So my wife, Elise Hollander, wrote a script called Blonde Ambition, which was the number one script on the 2016 blacklist, which was a biopic of Madonna, kind of breaking through in the early 1980s. And of course, as you might expect, that resulted in a lot of people coming to her for music biopics and music-oriented movies. So she's written a number of those. She's written other things, but she's written a number of those. And so, you know, if you are writing a certain kind of script, it's going to put your work out there into the world. And A, is that kind of stuff that you want to do? Because you're going to get offered it a lot. And secondly, you know, is there a market for that? You know, and I think if it's a straight up drama script, they don't make as many of those anymore. And so sometimes even if you get on the blacklist for the script, it doesn't necessarily result in a flood of opportunities, because there aren't a flood of opportunities to have necessarily. And so that is something to think about, really, is, you know, sometimes it just gets people, the writer and people's writers, but then you have to follow it up with the next script or the next opportunity. So, you know, you can put someone into the game, but the hope is that there are opportunities for them to follow up on, and also that they can take advantage of having their time in the spotlight and follow it up with something that is saleable, you know, because that's really about is getting a client paid at the end of the day and making them a professional writer.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because I do think that, you know, people don't have a really good sense of what a writer's life is like. You know, we know the stories of the Shane Blacks and that sort of, but on an average, you know, workaday writer, what is that career track like? And you as a manager and working for, or I guess, you know, owning a management company, how is that different than what an agent does and what an agency does?
Right. Well, I mean, look, the agent manager question is probably the biggest question that I think most people who are not in the industry, and even when they are, they have a hard time understanding it. The simple way to think about it is that, and in my experience, more often than not, an agent has like hundreds of clients, and they are mostly focused on selling their existing material and putting them for opportunities. They are less involved in working with them on a day-to-day basis. I see my role, and look, there are a lot of managers, and a lot of managers manage differently. Some operate more like agents, some, I don't know, producers. You know, for me, it's almost like the Jerry Maguire methodology: fewer clients, more focus on working with them, developing material. That's certainly my skill set, is working with them close. The big difference is agents are licensed by the state, so they cannot produce, which got you into the whole ATA production company issue a couple of years ago. Managers can produce. They are not licensed by the state. So that, you know, can be a cause for concern. And it's just also just, it gives you more flexibility for people if they like to produce. I occasionally produce. I have a pretty strict rule about producing, which is, you know, inherently it has to be my idea or an idea that I bring to a client. So in the case of Infinite, it was a book called The Reincarnationist Papers that I optioned and brought to Ian Shore to write. So, you know, things like that more often than not. Sometimes I'll come on if I really been like working on a script for 2 to 3 years and have radically changed the idea from where it was. But more often than not, I try to be pretty strict about it. Personally, I think there's two kinds of managers. There are managers who occasionally produce, which is where I would put myself. And then producers who occasionally manage, which is some other people. So that's kind of the question with that. In terms of the day-to-day of a writer, I mean, I'm married to one in addition to repping, representing writers. So I have a pretty close look at it. There's a great Twitter thread by a writer called Colby Day, who actually did a Medium post about his kind of life, a year in his life, I think 2021. That's worth checking out. That really goes into detail every month about what he did, worked on that month, and where it came to fruition. A lot of it is working on opportunities. So there are things called OWAs, or open writing assignments, and writers, their studios or financiers and people that have money will say, hey, we are looking for someone to adapt this book, or we're looking for a snowboarding movie or whatever. And then you'll go to writers, you'll send them a bunch of writers. They'll say, okay, we like this writer and that writer. Can they come in and pitch us a take on this book or whatever? And the writer has to obviously like the book as well. And so then they come and they pitch their take, and then maybe they pitch it to producer. Producer says, I like it, change the stuff about it. Then they change it, and then the producer changes more stuff, then changes more. So then they go pitch the studio, and the studio, maybe the studio gives them some thoughts, and they come back. They could pitch to the VP, and the VP says, do change this thing about it before you go to the president of the company. And they go to the president, and they bring the president like 3, maybe 4 writers. And then maybe they pick one of those people. Or maybe they say, I don't like any of them, and they don't. Or suddenly the president gives it to their best buddy, who's a writer director. You know, yeah. So like, and but think about it. Like, I named those like 3 or 4 writers that got brought to the president. There probably were like 12 to 15 who didn't even get that far, you know. And yeah. By the way, when I'm saying they pitched the producer, I'm talking about months of work, you know. And by the way, at the end of the day, because it's based on a book, any of that work that you did, you don't own it. I mean, well, it's not that you don't own it. You can't do anything with it because it's based on this book that you do not own, you know. And so there's a lot of doing that, which is why I try to be select. I encourage my clients to be selective about the OWAs that they engage on. You know, there's developing ideas with producers. There's maybe writing your own spec screenplay, going up. If you're TV, you're going up for staffing jobs to try and staff on various TV shows. You're doing a lot of general meetings, which is when you meet with producers, executives, sometimes directors or actors, to talk about potentially ways that you could work together. So, you know, that's a lot of kind of what the writer's life is. It's rarely the same thing day in and day out. There's a lot of uncertainty to it. And, you know, and there also is this idea, sometimes you have a script that you take out and it dies. And then a year later, suddenly someone's like, hey, remember that script? I showed it to this director. They love it. Let's get going again on it, you know? So there's a lot of ups and downs to it. And I really tell my clients, there's only 2 things you can control in this world, in this industry. And it is the quality of the material you put into the world and the quantity of it, as in how often. You know, I'd rather have a client put out 1, maybe 2 scripts a year that are like A+ quality or A- or whatever, than put out 4 scripts that are C+ quality, you know? So that's beyond that, you have no control how your scripts will be received, what will sell, what will not sell, what job you'll get, what job you don't get. You know, I had a client who was pitching on a big project. They got really far along. Producer loved them. Studio loved them. And then the director was like, actually, I've decided that I'm going to rewrite the script myself, even though that had not been the plan previously, you know. And they wasted everyone's time, you know. And then shortly after that, I heard they got kicked off. But, you know, it was just, it's one of those things where there's so much uncertainty in the business. It can be super frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, I am always shocked when I talk to my like successful writer friends who are working in feature films.
Perceived
and, you know,
successful,
and,
yes.
I think fair to say.
Well, I'm not trying to.
From my perspective.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'm not trying to like diminish your friends. I'm just saying, like, if you talk to those writers that you're a successful person, they go, really? It doesn't feel like that every day.
Well, but this is, you know, usually what they say is like, I just lost a bake-off to this other guy over here. And I certainly did not until, you know, I started talking to folks a little more about this. But I did not appreciate just how much of the job is auditioning for work. It's not sitting down and writing. It's going to somebody and essentially asking for permission to write and then writing and then comparing that work with like 5 other people who have all written similar takes on it.
So I, one of my first jobs was working for a writer called Andrew Marlowe, who wrote Air Force One, Hollowman, End of Days, went on to create Castle, now co-runs The Equalizer with his wife, Terry Miller, also a writer. And so I worked for Andrew and Terry. And I remember talking to Andrew and I asked him, I was like, what percentage of a writer's career do you think is based around their actual talent? And what do you think, or their writing skill? And what percentages do you think is based around their ability to be great in a room? I want to say Andrew said something like 70% was being great in a room and 30% was the talent. I don't remember the exact specifics, but I was like more like 60-40, and he went beyond that, I think. And the talent is what gets you in the room with the people, but there's a lot of talented people. So what distinguishes you, it can be your ability to get in the room. I remember someone was telling me about a very successful writer who's now a writer, director, producer, and they were like, he can get in the room with five people with different agendas and come back out and make them all feel heard and deliver pages that make them all feel heard. He's like, the person was telling me, the pages won't be amazing, but they will make everyone feel like they were listened to. I think it's funny when you think about writers, you think about Charlie Kaufman and the awkwardness and things like that. But the reality is successful feature writers can oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes be very, very, you know, charismatic forces, and they often turn into directors, you know. Mm-hmm. If you think about, you know, the Aaron Sorkins of the world, Scott Frank, et cetera, they often become writer or directors or showrunners because they have a real force of nature personality, which, you know, is not what you often ascribe to screenwriters. But I think it is a necessity. Well, maybe not a necessity, it can be a value add for a writer to have that personality, and sometimes can cover up writing talent maybe that doesn't match the quality of someone else who is not quite as charismatic.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit. I wanted to come back to this, the decline of the spec script market. I mean, is this on the one hand, you look at the world of filmmaking and film distribution and you see like, all right, we've got Netflix, we've got HBO Max, we've got Hulu, you know, we've got an entire indie studio ecosystem. Like, surely there's more stuff than ever, and there's only so many intellectual properties.
Do we really have an indie studio system ecosystem?
So this is part of the question, right? Is that why from your POV as somebody who's worked in the industry for, you know, for all this time, for 20 some years, what has happened to the world of filmmaking that has narrowed the focus so much that spec, if you write a great spec script, everybody's just going to say, yeah, but why would I make this?
I think the biggest thing is the decline of the DVD market. The DVD market allowed for a lot of mid-budget movies to get made without a focus on foreign revenue. And that allowed, if you made a movie and it made $20 million, it was almost guaranteed to make $20 million in domestic DVD revenue. So you could make movies that were mid-budget that were aimed towards the domestic market. You know, and so that opened up. And so when you're thinking of the foreign marketplace, you're more often thinking less specific things, like cultural specific things like comedies or dramas. You know, when you're thinking the foreign marketplace, you're thinking horror, thriller, action, because that is something that tends to travel a little more widely, or at least is perceived as such. And so that's one thing. And they tend to, you know, want, you know, the same kind of stars. And, you know, the idea out there, rightly or wrongly, is that the foreign marketplace is slower to catch up to where the domestic marketplace. Someone could be a star in America, but it might take a couple of years for them to become a star around the world. Like, let's say, I'm going to pull a name out of a hat, Margaret Qualley, who is a phenomenal actress, and anyone would be incredibly fortunate to have her lead their movies. But there might be a perception that she's not a worldwide star yet because she hasn't been in a Marvel movie or something, you know, so that's kind of part of the issue. You know, I mean, another big thing has been the relentless focus since 2008 on IP, you know, and this idea that we want to make big. You know, why make $100 million when you can make $1 billion? You know, that sort of thinking that is kind of geared towards it. Now, you might be like, well, Netflix and all these other places, they make a lot of smaller movies. what is kind of seems like it's happened, certainly lately in the marketplace, is that those places are less interested in movies that are just clean spec scripts. And what I mean by that is like script that doesn't have a director or an actor involved. They are in the business of making movies. And so they want movies to come to them with a director and an actor, maybe more than one actor. And so they just press a button and say, go. And so that results in a lot more having to do this work independent before you get to the studio, putting people on these movies, doing things like that, you know? And it's just, it's hard. It's really, really hard. And the studios are less interested in development. You know, the streamers are very disinterested in development. They want finished things that they can just say mm-hmm. yes to. And if it's not a finished thing, like, I think if I brought them a big toy brand or something, if I'm like, hey, guess what? I have Castlevania, or not that my buddy does it, but like Mario, Super Mario or something, yeah. you know, they would be like, oh yeah, we'll develop that. But like, they're not interested in like an original script necessarily. It happens. Don't get me wrong. It does happen. But the frequency which happens, it's just not as much as it used to be. You know, for example, horror scripts, they're, you know, those do sell, but often they're like, well, who's the director? How do we get this made? And so it feels to me like there's much more impatience and there's less of the development work that people used to do. You know, it feels like it's been a gradual process, but it's kind of like that line, God, is it East of Eden, Steinbeck, where it says, you know, how did you go broke, you know, slowly then all at once, you know? And that's what it feels like the change in the spec market has been. It's been a slow decline and then all at once, you know, and it does feel very, very difficult to spells feature spec screenplays nowadays.
Yeah. Whenever you see a script get sold, it's usually like because Brad Pitt is attached and, you know, I don't know.
If it's got some big star attached, that it got written a year or two earlier because it took that long to like all the pieces to come together more often. Right. I mean, look, if it's written by an incredibly well-known writer, if it's written by like Billy Ray or something, then like that goes to the top of the pile because, you know, he is a phenomenal, well-known writer, director, you know. But if it's written by a nobody, it's a lot harder to get traction. It can happen. Don't get me wrong, but it happens much less often. And it's just difficult, you know?
Yeah. I mean, would you say that spec scripts are more or less just tryout pieces for other things at this point?
I would say that's a reasonable expectation to have, I would say. It's certainly not how I approach the material. I try to sell every single script. But what I want it to do is to do both. I want it to be a potential piece of business as well as something that could be a great sample going forward for the work that the client wants to do. You know, sometimes like I'm working on a script we're going to take out relatively shortly, and it is geared to be a sub $10 million, you know, piece for an actor in their 60s, 50s, 60s or 70s, you know? So, but it's a thriller, you know? And so we're like, okay, maybe we can kind of do a version of like Harry Brown or something, the Michael Caine film, you know, where we're not going after the Brad Pitts. We're not going after, I mean, although I think he is now in his 50s, but we're not going after, you know, we're going after, you know, this would have been a great movie for Bob Hoskins, for example. I mean, obviously he passed away, but like this is something for Morgan Freeman. This is something for, you know, an actor in that age range, you know, because it speaks to kind of like late in life vibe, you know. So that's one strategy we're trying to do, where that would be, you know, we're aiming after an actor, an age range that doesn't get lead roles quite as often, you know. So that's one way to do it. You know, I have another project that's a horror film. And that one, we partner with a well-known horror producer. We're in talks with directors. So the idea would be to get a director on board, maybe take some shots at actresses because it's led by an actress. And then, you know, if we can get someone, great. If not, it may not be the end of the world because it's a horror movie. It's not quite as important as it would be for a drama piece. And then go out and try to get it done. You know, I have another script that is a biopic and we have a great actress on board. We have a great director on board. We're trying to find an actor because it's a two-hander and then we would take it out. And so you're trying to put all the pieces together in a way that maybe you wouldn't have 10 years ago when you could say, this is a great script. Let's have the studio be our partner in helping us find people.
Yeah. One of your clients has a movie coming out in just a couple of days, a week now,
yeah,
right?
The
new Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes, Chris Devlin wrote
How did that come about? What was your involvement and your client's involvement? I mean, was this Was the studio looking for pitches? Was it something you know, they'd put together? How'd that work?
Well, I'm good friends with a guy named John Silk, who was an executive at Legendary at the time. And so John and I were talking, or maybe he called me and he's like, yeah, we're looking for writers for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I flagged Chris Thomas Devlin, who I think he was already familiar with. Chris had written a bunch of great scripts, had written Cobweb, which at the time had sold to Lionsgate. That since went on to get made by a great director called Samuel Bodin with Vertigo, Roy Lee's company, and Point Grey, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg's company producing, as well as John Berg, who worked at Vertigo at the time. So that already kind of was moving, I think, towards production at the time. I can't remember exactly. And so I was like, well, you know, what about Chris? And so he either was already familiar with Chris or he read Chris. And he's like, yeah, this is great. Chris came in. I think Fede Alvarez was already on board to produce with his producing partner. Fede heard all the pitches, decided Chris was, I think, the best one, but had a very singular vision for the film. And so, Chris worked with, Fede and his producing partner. I mean, I think they ended up getting story credit, which gives you a clear idea of the level of their involvement on it. And so, yeah, that was kind of the experience on that one. It's relatively straightforward. It was, I think, around Robin where they went to a bunch of people and then they decided that Chris was the person they liked the best. And then Chris worked on it all the way through.
Nice.
That was one of the more, that's the more straightforward story, I would say, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like everything just kind of worked out there.
I mean, although what I would say is, like, Chris had a particular take. I don't know that take, I think elements of that take ended up in the movie, but I think it was very much Fede had a vision and felt like Chris was the person to execute that vision.
Interesting. Again, that comes out on Netflix.
February 18th.
On the 18th, so check it out. That was mostly what I wanted to ask. I mean, I do just have a general question. What is, you know, beyond trying to sell scripts for your clients and that sort of thing, what is your day to day like as a manager? I mean, what sort of fires are you putting out? What sort of calls are you fielding? I mean, I'm always kind of curious what goes on behind the scenes when, you know, a writer or a director or somebody is kind of freaking out because something is happening and calls you and says, what do I do?
Well, I mean, that's different from my day to day because that is thankfully not something that happens a great deal. You know, I mean, look, when it comes to a crisis, you just try to, you're always asking yourself, honestly, the first question is how much leverage do I have, you know? And sometimes you have no leverage. Sometimes you just have to deal with the situation as it plays. And you can try to appeal to people's moral character or like doing the right thing. But like, you know, or basically be like, hey, if you do this, like, I'm never like talking to you again. My company's never talking to you again because this, what you're doing is completely wrong. You know, but, you know, you're really looking at the situation and being like, how can I manage this in a scenario where my client gets the optimal outcome, but also being realistic about it. I didn't come up in an agency. I'm not a screamer. I'm not the kind of person where, you know, I'm going to, you know, where you're going to like start making death threats or something. You know, I'm always thinking like, how can I represent my clients in the best way possible? And still, you know, because sometimes you say crazy stuff and then the situation gets resolved. Like I had a situation where things went badly with a producer and one of my clients, and my client had a very clear, they were like, I'm going to do X amount of work and that's that. And the producer was pushing them to do more. And we tried to find a compromise didn't work. We kind of walked away, but like, you know, at the end of the day, feelings weren't brutalized the way that they might have been necessarily. And then, you know, it turned out actually that the producer found a studio who was willing to put money up to do the work. And so it all had a happy ending. And thankfully, I didn't say like, you're the piece of shit. I don't know if I can say that. I never want to work with you ever again or whatever. So like, it wasn't, when we all came back together, it wasn't like I had to like apologize for anything. All I could do was state where my client's opinion was, where the line in the sand was. And that's what we had to live and die by. You know, my day to day, honestly, it's kind of like a writer's in a weird way where it really changes depending. It goes day to day. It really is different. You know, I'm probably going to be taking on a script next week. So that's going to be a lot of phone calls and emails of getting the script out. You know, in a normal time, I honestly, pre-pandemic, I would take a script on a Monday or Tuesday, hope to get some responses by Friday. Nowadays, for whatever reason, you know, maybe because the market has slowed down, maybe because people are in their offices, I don't know. You know, it's for whatever reason, it feels like reads take a lot longer. So I probably won't get any, probably get some reads before by Friday. A lot of reads probably won't happen until the next week or the week after, you know. So you're kind of, you're putting together a list of the people to go to. You're going to them, can take a little minute to connect. You're getting them all the material out to people. You know, other than that, it's like reading new people, potentially meeting with new people if I like them, seeing if I connect with them, you know, meeting executives, meeting people around town, asking what they're looking for, sending over my client's material when I think that it, they could be a good fit for the opportunities that the person's looking for. You know, you're basically, you're working with your client, your pre-existing clients on their material, helping shape their careers. You're potentially finding new people, reading new people and meeting with them about potentially signing with them. And you're going out there and you're meeting other people in town saying, hey, what are you looking for? Hey, I think these clients might be a good fit. That's kind of like the three buckets of what the day really is, you know, is dealing with those things, you know. So that's kind of what the day is. And it's just what configuration does that fit into your day? And I mean, that's one of the things I like about what I do for a living is that every day is not the same. It's not a 9-to-5 thing. Now, look, that can be grueling because I can have to work quite late because I have a lot to deal with or I have like a bunch of reading to do. And then I go another day when it's pretty light and I can, you know, focus on clearing out my email inbox or reading new submissions. So but there is a certain unpredictability to it that is both gratifying in terms of being interesting, but also, I think, you know, I don't have any children yet, but hoping to soon, but I have friends who do have children and it can be, you know, the unpredictability is not helpful when you need a little bit more stability in your life.
Yeah. Well, I can confirm that as a child having person myself. I
believe the term for that is that, parent. Yes.
I don't want to give myself a title here. That was everything I wanted to ask. I always like to end the show by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about, the state of Hollywood or, you know, if how to break into the business, whatever. What should I have asked that I did not ask of you?
I don't know. I don't know in terms of a question. I would say the one thing that I've encountered, this is more of a Twitter thing than anything, which obviously you and I are quite active on, is there's a funny idea. And actually you spoke to it earlier on where you're talking about your successful writer friends and the amount of rejection they still faced. I think there's a perception that once you sell a movie or get a movie made or that it's all easy street from then. And I think, you know, I was talking to a client yesterday who just got staffed on her first show and I was so happy for her and it's been a long road. And I was like, you know what? It's going to be easier going forward. It'll never be easy, but it'll be a little bit easier. It might be 10% easier going forward, you know? And I think that's the reality is when you do successes or things that are perceived as success, it never gets easy, but it does get a little bit easier. So I think the thing I would say to be mindful of is when you look at someone who's having what you might perceive as a successful career, it's just to know that things are not always necessarily easy for them and that, you know, everyone I think has their struggles and that it's a difficult industry. It's a very much a time of change in our industry and everyone's having a way to adjust to that. And I think that's the one thing I've kind of become more mindful of, weirdly being more active on Twitter and seeing kind of like pylons and being the subject of pylons is that it sounds, I guess, a little cliche, a little Hallmark cardy, but everyone's going through their own battles necessarily. And just because someone is perceived as successful and therefore should never be able to complain or therefore it should be easy or they should be rich or whatever is it does not necessarily make it so. And so I think that is something I'm trying to keep in mind every day. Is giving people, I guess, a little bit more leeway or grace because everyone's got their thing that they're going on. So I think that's the funny, interesting thing with the career is you can have someone who's been nominated for an Oscar and they're still maybe being like, oh my God, am I still a viable person in this business? There's a certain insecurity that never quite goes away in this business. And I think the business is not unaware of that in terms of how they treat people a little bit like they're disposable or what have you done for me lately kind of situation. So that's it. I think I would just try to be, you know, if there's something out there that people should know about the business, and it's that it's a fickle business. And just because someone seems more successful than you are doesn't mean that they are necessarily everything's perfect in their life, you know, and to grant them a little bit of grace.
Yeah. Be nice to people on the internet. That is a general. That is a good general rule.
In all things, certainly. It would be nice. And it's weird. I feel like people would be much nicer to people in real life than they necessarily do to the random ideas. But I guess it's like, you know, the deadline commenters or something like that. They're like, yet another thing or whatever. Like, you know, I always think of like the movie reviewers when they're reviewing a movie and they're like, the script sucked by so-and-so. And I'm like, so-and-so is clearly a terrible writer. I'm like, man, I guarantee you that however you think that, if you think the movie was bad, the writer probably agrees with you. Maybe not the specific review, but like, I always thought that was funny. I remember when I first did my first internship in Hollywood, I asked my boss, I was like, oh man, blah. He's like, oh, so-and-so's a good writer. I'm like, really? I just saw that new movie. It sucked. And then they wrote it. And he's like, and the guy was like, he's like, if a movie is bad, the writer is the least person to blame for it. You know, he's like, the first person is probably the studio, and then it's the movie star, then it's the director, or it was something like that, right? Like who is the most powerful person in the situation, and that's kind of where you want to ascribe the blame. And by the way, the writer's probably like number 7 or 8 on that chart, which A, speaks to the reality situation, but also speaks to like the craziness of Hollywood, that the person who is credited with writing the screenplay has the least influence on the whole thing.
Yes, that's another thing I've learned from my screenwriter friends, is it's almost never the writer's fault for what you see on the
screen.
No
one's ever like, the director wanted to do it, but the writer said we couldn't do it. So therefore, I mean, in television, yes, television is a whole different beast, which we didn't really touch on at all in our conversation. But in features, no one's ever like, yeah, I wanted to, the movie star really wanted to like give his character a dog, but the writer said they wouldn't have it. So therefore we just said, okay, I guess we can't do it. I guess that's it. And in reality, they're like, and you're fired, and we're getting a writer. And what is the mandate for the new writer? Get the movie star a dog. Okay, done. Done. The character now is a dog.
Yeah. Maybe. Well, next time we can talk about TV, because that is a whole different kettle of fish. But thank you very much for being on, John. I really appreciate it. Again, check out the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie on Netflix on February 18th. Everyone is super excited about that. I am Sonny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode. See you guys then.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.